Women are rising, rising up. Women are rising, rising up. Women are rising, rising up. Women are rising, rising up.
Welcome back to KPFK's 4 o'clock hour. This is the Voices from the Frontline segment, and we are now going to be talking to Ruthie Gilmore, prison abolitionist and professor of geography, American studies, and ethnicity at the University of Southern California. And we'll be talking to her about the prison industrial complex and, in particular, emphasis placed on women, which is one of the fastest growing populations that are in the California prison system. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Damon. It is great to be on this show, and it's nice to be back on KPFK.
So let's start a little bit by talking about the histories of prisons in the U.S., and in particular in California. And I know there are a couple of different humps where things happen. And one, I believe, is around when there was a transition from when slavery was outlawed. You have a couple, like Angola, which was a plantation that changed into a prison. So that's one. And then the second is this huge boom in the 80s and 90s in which there are about 17 prisons, if my count is correct, that were built.
In fact, California built 23 prisons in that period.
23.
It's even huger than you realize. It's hard to keep track. Let's go back to the 19th century for a couple of minutes here and talk about that transition from slavery to after slavery. I won't call it slavery to freedom exactly. One of the things that happened in the U.S. Southeast is this. The former slave owners and their political cronies were in a quandary when they lost their wealth because they had been labor lords. They owned human beings and therefore the labor of human beings. And they became landlords, which is to say they owned land, which then they had to figure out how to make productive. And they did this in a number of ways, most particularly by using laws that basically circumvented the constitutional amendments that came into being after the end of the Civil War to keep people in virtual peonage, which is to say effectively in slavery, and force folks to work in plantation situations, but much more importantly, building the infrastructure and the early industrial capacity of what became the modern South. So the railroads and mines and steel mills and so forth that developed in the South were very much built with the labor of former slaves who were caught up in that burgeoning, quote-unquote, criminal justice system of the U.S. Southeast. And interestingly enough, one of the things that happened at the end of the 19th century should be instructive to people who imagine that what the great scourges at the beginning of the 21st century is privatization. That's not quite the case. At the end of the 19th century, what happened is that a lot of poor workers who were not prisoners, who were not convicts, who were predominantly, although not exclusively, white in the U.S. Southeast started to protest that they couldn't get jobs because the convicts held all the jobs that free world workers might have gotten, might have competed for, jobs growing and building and moving things. And so two big reforms that were put into place at the end of the 19th century ended convict leasing, but established the totally public convict-labored plantations of Angola and Louisiana, which still operates today, and Parchment in Mississippi. So we have to think more broadly than privatization when we think about prison, and we have to think very skeptically of reform when we see that what reform has done is built a bigger system. So in California in the late 20th century, started on what one state analyst called the biggest prison building project in the history of the world. That's their words, not mine. And what they did was made a plan to build prison after prison after prison up and down the state. Interestingly enough, these decisions and then the project itself came long after crime in this state, as well as crime throughout the United States, had peaked, and its drop was very well reported. So prison expansion does not, as many people like to think, explain why crime has gone down in the United States. And in fact, places where there more prisons have been built in the last 20 years have had a lower drop in crime than places that have not resorted to prison after prison after prison. So California built 23 new prisons up and down the state, mostly crowded into California's agricultural Central Valley. And included in those prisons were three major prisons for women and a number of smaller facilities dotted around the state. So that brings us to the topic for today, March 8th, 2004, which is International Women's Day, and what is the effect on prison expansion on women in California, in the United States, and in the world. There are a couple of things that we need to think about. One is, for a long time in the 80s and the 90s, women were the fastest growing group of prisoners. Very, very quick growing. And obviously, the expanded capacity that the state built by building these three prisons up in the Central Valley encouraged county courts, state courts, to send women into prison who otherwise might not have been convicted of felonies and sent away at all.
And you call it a prison industrial complex for a reason. And what are some of the other institutions that benefit from the increased incarceration of people, in particular women?
The people who benefit the most in California fall into two groups. One group is the staff, the 49,247 people who work for the California Department of Corrections. And the rest are different kinds of vendors who sell stuff to the prison system. So they might sell equipment, or they might sell some of the food, or they might sell other things. But California prisons are, with the exception of a few tiny prisons, all public agencies, totally publicly owned and operated, and the biggest beneficiary of all of this flow of $5.7 billion a year through that system is the California Correctional Peace Officers Association, which is to say the Guards Union. They are 32,500 or so of the total number of people who work in the prison, and anybody who's been reading the papers, even haphazardly over the past few months, will see that there's been scandal after scandal after scandal associated with the corrupt practices of this Guards Union and the Guards Union's amazing power over legislatures. Davis was, you know, the wholly owned thing of the prison guards. And prison abolitionists couldn't have had a worse governor, I assure you, even in including the guy who's in office right now.
Oh, right. Like, which one are you talking about?
No, Davis. You know, right. I mean, who reduced the number of people in prison while he was governor over the last 40 years? The only person who's done that self-consciously and deliberately was Ronald Reagan.
Of all people.
Schwarzenegger's hero, yeah. So it's not about Democrats and Republicans. It's about something else. Mostly it's about modestly educated women and men who, in a different relationship of capitalism and state, would have made livings making, moving, growing, and taking care of things. But since so many of those avenues for employment and for the ability to, you know, have a life and raise a family and be happy, whatever way you might define happiness, have been eroded with the changes in the political economy that we all call, for shorthand, globalization, means that more and more people are pushed to the margins, and those are the very people we find in prison after prison after prison,
right.
Particularly women who have been sent on convictions that relate generally to drug offenses.
And I just recommend everybody to check out our website, www.prisonactivists.org. They have tons and tons of material that you can get more information about the prison system. But if we just look at California three strikes, 60% of the people who are on there are black, whereas only about 11% of the population of California is black. So, I mean, there's a couple layers. There's a layer of national oppression and racism that's operative, but then there's also the stuff around patriarchy. The Prison Activist website says that in California, possession and sale of controlled substances are the top two charges for people entering prison. The stuff that you would say, you know, people would vote for more money for prison, the murder, manslaughter, kidnapping, etc., they don't even make the top 10. So along with the drug stuff, what are some of the other ways that, in particular, women of color get caught up in the prison system?
Well, you know, there's basically two major categories. I call them categories of illness, drugs, alcohol, that kind of thing, and the category of income, particularly things like writing a bad check. And, you know, all California all voted last night to, you know, write more bad checks for the budget. And yet an individual who writes a bad check might find herself with a felony and several years in prison.
I also heard that in Oakland there were women who were getting checks from the state and they were being overpaid. The state was going after them saying that you owe us money and trying to bring charges against them.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you think about it, Damon, we've got, you know, everyday life in so many ways has been criminalized for so many people. And what that word means, criminalized, means that behavior that didn't used to be forbidden or forbidden was not illegal, as in illegal under criminal law, has become criminal. And so more and more people face the threat of felony charges for doing desperate, I will admit, desperate acts, but not acts that ought to be punished. I mean, if people don't have enough money to pay their bills, there ought to be something in place other than putting people in prison.
Right. There's also another piece, too, and there's the charge of conspiracy, which is, from what I understand, is if somebody in your family is selling drugs or whatnot, and if you don't report them, you can be done by that. And then maybe even another thing that we should talk about is self-defense against domestic violence.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk for a minute about conspiracy. Interestingly enough, it isn't against the law in general not to report a crime that you might have heard about. The famous case in that area was the case of those two boys who killed a little girl in Las Vegas, and one of the boys knew that the other boy did it but didn't tell anybody. And he wasn't liable for anything because there's no law against not reporting a crime. But if you might know certain things that fall under these amazingly flexible and sticky drug laws and racketeering laws, then suddenly you become a conspirator. So it's not so much that you didn't report some crime that you noticed, but you can be characterized as involved in the crime and therefore face punishment along with other people. And lots of folks have, more often under federal drug laws than under California state drug laws, have gotten caught up that way and are doing very, very long, serious time behind the allegations that they knew something and didn't say anything about it. But let's talk about domestic violence, because that raises a whole lot of really important issues, and I know we don't have a lot of time. Some number of women who are behind bars in California and throughout the United States are there because they defended themselves against people who were abusing them, harming them, hurting them, and their children. Generally, it is women defending them against men, but there are a few cases of the reverse, as well as women against women and men against men. But the most normal type of case is women against men. And many women are doing life without possibility of parole or doing practically the same thing, 25 to life, because they defended themselves. Now, this in a country where, quote-unquote, self-defense is so worshipped as an inherent right that people won't do anything to control the circulation and sale of guns because everybody's supposed to have the right to defend themselves, but not in the case of poor women, right? And these are poor women with very few exceptions. So what's happened now is there are a couple of organizations, one in California and one national organization, that are taking up this issue. One is Justice Now, which is based up in Oakland, California, an abolitionist organization that does work on a very individualized scale trying to get women who have been convicted on such charges consideration for hearings and parole and release. And there have been some successes in that area. Justice Now does other work, but that is one of their focuses. And the second group, and this is, I think, important for the listeners to know about, the second group is Insight, Women of Color Against Violence. And Insight came into being a few years ago, and the focus of Insight is kind of centers around this issue. The prison industrial complex has expanded, as you mentioned earlier, Damon, because of the way that racism and the criminal justice system work. In California, a third of all prisoners in the system, slightly more than a third, are Latinos, mostly Chicanos, other Latinos, and then about equally 30-30 white and black, and then the balance are Native American and Asian American. And also, on the other hand, women who are likely to experience domestic violence tend to be poor women from communities very much like the communities where predominantly men are sent to prison. So what Insight tries to do is say, all right, how can we intervene in this problem in our community without resorting to prisons and policing as the way out? How can we change how our relationships are so that we don't send more men to prison in order to protect women? Because that's not working either. So Insight is doing really great work in finding grassroots organizations all around the country that have developed models and techniques for helping women, and if they find the men, you know, get out of abusive relationships and finding the root cause of abusive relationships in order to change those practices and stop the growth of the prison industrial complex.
So, Ruthie, I was trying to prepare some questions for you, and I think I have questions for probably about 3 hours.
Okay.
I'm going to kind of lay out about 3 different things, and I want you to just talk about what you will with that. So the first one is regarding the U.S. and the role in the world. The U.S. is 5% of the world's population, but has 20% of the combined world's total as far as incarcerated people. And so we look at how the U.S. exports a lot of just crap around the world, from McDonald's to toxic chemicals to political regimes, you name it. One, to see how the incarceration within this country of women in particular, or just in general, how that affects the international scheme of things, how that relates to imperialism, et cetera. So that's one piece. The second one is regarding progressive movements in the left in terms of de-incarceration. There's a general agreement and unity from progressive and left groups that, particularly because of race, national oppression, but then also stuff around just a faulty system, innocent people being locked up, I think most general progressive people would say, hey, we need to get a lot of these people out of jail. And I think a lot of it is based on how you frame it, because I would frame it as it's just completely wrong morally, whereas you have people like Arnold Schwarzenegger, right, who was saying how basically his thing is, you know, economically motivated. And a lot of people actually push that, saying we shouldn't really talk about the fact that black people and Latino people are overrepresented, but it's a real cost thing, and that's how we're going to get people out, which they can fiddle that around any way they want. And I think in terms of that, looking at what is the abolitionist strategy, because I think a lot of people in particular, when you're looking in communities, when I'm on the bus talking to folks, black folks on the bus, there's this law and order mentality. It's like, well, we need the police to protect us, but we just don't want them to beat us. And so what kind of demands do we put out? How do we get things out there that the black community in particular, but also Latino community, oppressed nationality communities can actually embrace as demands, one, to de-incarcerate people, but two, to kind of rally around the rights of women and oppressed nationality within the prison system?
Okay, those are 3 great questions, and now we have 2 minutes left. So here we go. abolitionism. Abolitionism is a really hard one, as you know. And the way in which many of us approach this goal is, of course, incrementally through what we call non-reformist reforms. Are there ways to, one, keep people out of prison in the first place, which is to say keep people from even being in the shadow of a felony conviction in the first place, through adequate education, nutrition, all of those things that make it possible for people to stay away from the ever-widening net of the criminal justice system? And on the other hand, are there ways that we can understand how to get people who have been living part or all of their lives in cages, human beings in cages, out and keep them out? I actually don't go for the innocence defense because I don't think that most guilty people should be spending part or all of their lives in cages, but rather we should figure out different systems of accountability and responsibility. And these different systems already exist in the world. It's not like it's utopia in my head, but it's actually real in places like Spain and Iceland and in many communities in the greater third world. So there are things we can do. The second thing is progressive movements on the left are kind of nervous, I think, in many ways about taking up prison because they actually fall into that innocence guilty trap or the violence nonviolence trap instead of seeing how anti-racist activism is anti-prison activism because of the way that, as you said, you know, the brunt of imprisonment falls on brown people, black people, red people, yellow people, and poor white people, right? It's also anti-poverty activism. And so if one pays lip service to those kinds of activisms, then one must become an anti-prison activist by including on whatever the agenda is, whether it's labor or other kinds of agenda, the agenda of anti-prison. And we see in this state already amazingly great coalitions that have been built up painstakingly over time that are addressing these issues. The SEIU has joined a coalition with Critical Resistance and California Prison Moratorium Project and Catholic Charities and a number of other organizations to work very hard to reduce the number of people in prison through changing sentencing laws and other things. Another coalition called CURB, has brought together a number of grassroots organizations in the Bay Area and increasingly throughout the state to work to close prisons so that people who might get out of prison because of this budgetary anomaly cannot be sent back because there won't be any cages for them, and therefore alternatives will have to come about. And the last thing, which was your first question, has to do with systems of governance. Anyone's been paying attention to Haiti and anybody's been paying attention to Iraq knows that the United States is aggressively exporting its systems of governance, and we see it all over the world. And it's very important for people to say the state can be something other than what the U.S. state has become. And the state need not be a carceral state and can still be a welfare state. And we've got to stand up for capital W welfare for all women, children, and men in this world. And that's my message for International Women's Day.
If people wanted more information about prison abolition, et cetera, is there a website that people can go to?
Yep, a few websites. If you're interested in education, not incarceration, go to www.may8.org. If you're interested in abolition in general, go to www.criticalresistance.org. If you're interested in getting involved in the short term and you're interested in community colleges, show up in Sacramento Monday, March 15th for a rally against sea hikes that are pushing working class people out of post-secondary education. And otherwise, look around you. There's somebody in your community, wherever you are, who's doing work. Critical Resistance here in Los Angeles, California Prison Moratorium Project in the Central Valley, Justice Now and other organizations in the Bay Area. We're everywhere, and we're here to work with you.
Ruthie Gilmore, Professor of Geography, American Studies, and Ethnicity at University of Southern California, and I actually met her up in the Critical Resistance Conference back in 98, which is one of the formative things in my political development. So thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Damon.
So thanks for joining us this week. We'd like to thank our guest, Leanne Hirstman, coordinator and lecturer at the National School for Strategic Organizing, and Ruthie Gilmore, professor of geography, American studies, and ethnicity at USC and prison abolitionist. Today we had music from Kate Bush, Sweet Honey in the Rock, and Judy Mowat. Please let us know what you think about the show. You can call us at 213-387-2800 or email us at comments@kpfk.org. We'd also like to thank our producer, Alan Minsky, and our engineer, Mark Maxwell. And just for all the ladies out there, I want to give a shout-out for International Women's Day. Remember, women, you hold up more than half the sky. See ya.